smile in her direction as he surrounded her hand with both of his. "Relax, Anne," he said calmly. After a long minute, she did, not even realizing she'd been so tense before. They rode in silence, listening to the clatter of the coach on the cobblestones, before Cedric slid her glove off and began to stroke her hand. He drew long, lazy patterns on her bare skin, and then turned her hand over to explore her palm, tracing her lifelines to the rapid pulse of the underside of her wrist. Then he did something she had not expected. He raised her hand up and pressed his lips to her wrist. Anne watched in fascination as he flicked his tongue against her skin, his lips curving into an unconscious smile, the way one does when tasting something unexpectedly sweet and the pleasure of it catches the taster off guard. Cedric then took one of her fingers into his mouth, sucking it between his lips. Anne held in a whimper at the sudden flush of heat and the aching throb that came from within. The feel of his mouth hot and wet around her finger did something to her. Her tongue moved out to wet her lips just as Cedric's tongue circled her finger, teasing it, caressing it. And then he lightly nipped her.
"Oh!"
Anne tried to jerk her hand back into her lap, but he did not let her go. Instead, he pulled her against him, his other arm banding around her waist.
"Ask me. Ask me to kiss you."
He dipped his head with exquisite slowness. When his nose brushed hers, his lips followed, sweeping against her slightly parted lips.
"Ask me to end your resistance. Let me inside you."
Had Anne been thinking clearly, she might have realized he meant more than something physical. But her mind was focused on the more literal images his words conjured. Cedric rising above her, propping himself on his arms as he buried himself deep between her legs. To her surprise, the image was not as unwelcome as she feared it might be. Her silence was answer enough. Cedric pushed her away from him so roughly that she fell back onto their shared seat with a startled gasp. For an instant she saw rage, disappointment, and despair on his face before he schooled his features back into that ever-mocking self-assurance. Cedric had let her retreat, but Anne worried that the smug look on his face promised future moments where she would not be allowed to do so. His arrogance angered her. She wanted to scream, to hit him, to leave the coach and go home, but she squared her shoulders and said nothing. It was the only way she could show him that he hadn't affected her. The trouble was, he had affected her, very deeply. Some dark part of her wanted his mouth back on her fingers and other places. She blushed, never more thankful he couldn't see her shame.
"Are you pleased to be dining with Emily tonight?" Cedric asked, as though he hadn't just made her speechless a moment before with that very mouth of his.
It also didn't fail to stir her jealousy that he and Emily were so close. Despite their bond of friendship, it still hurt to think Emily knew Cedric better than she did. Though Anne had never encouraged his attentions before the accident, a part of her had hoped he would not give up, that he wanted her enough to continue to fight for her. And Anne secretly wondered whether all of the men who'd abducted Emily had fallen in love with her to some degree. Their devotion to her was unshakable, and rakes never devoted themselves to anyone without reason. Cedric misinterpreted her silence.
"You're not pleased, then?"
"I'm sorry, I was wool gathering. Of course I'm happy to see Emily. I am just worried that she won't approve of my casting aside my morning clothes for her dinner tonight."
It was a lie. She wasn't worried about that at all, but he could never know her true reasons. Silly nonsense, to be jealous of her dear friend. Cedric sat up straighter, as though her admission caught his attention.
"You're not wearing black?"
"No. Somehow I felt it would make my father sad. He never approved of wearing mourning clothes for very long. He knows, wherever he is, that I..."
For a moment she could not speak. Her throat constricted and her eyes burned.
"I will not cry. I will not cry," I am not weak.
She repeated the mantra that had kept her from showing any strong emotion since her father died.
That you miss him, Cedric finished for her. Yes.
Anne wondered at the fact that he completed her sentence. Did he understand her so well? Or was she merely so transparent that even a blind man could see the depth of her grief?
So, if you're not wearing black, what are you wearing, my dear?
Cedric grinned wickedly, but the effect put her strangely at ease, dispelling the tension of her heavy sadness.
It is a simple satin gown, russet brown, with a bit of an autumnal orange hue to it, under the right light.
Cedric reached out, his hand settling on her thigh as he explored the feel of the satin beneath his fingers.
I'm glad you aren't wearing that awful black crepe any more. I despise the way it felt when I touched you. A woman's clothes should create pleasure when sliding against one's skin. It should entice her lover's touch.
Anne was bewitched by the spell his hand wove over her thigh, the slow exploring caress, so light that it did not disturb the satin, yet she felt the heat of his skin sink through her gown, creating a heady anticipation deep in her womb. His touch reminded her of her father's stable master, Harvey, as he worked with wild, unbroken geldings. Harvey always gentled the wildest of the young horses, with his soft whispers and feather-light touch. Suspicion suddenly flooded Anne. Was Cedric planning to lull her into thinking she was safe and then pounce? Surely that was his plan. Just as she steeled herself to demand he cease touching her, he stopped of his own accord and set his hand back on his lap as though nothing had happened.
I do not think Emily will mind you casting off your mourning blacks. Emily is a most understanding little creature. Sometimes I think she understands too much.
This last sentence was delivered in such a disgruntled mutter that Anne couldn't help but wonder what he meant. Not that she would dare ask.
I hope you're right, she murmured instead.
You'll soon find out that I'm often right. Do not be shocked by it.
His tone was imperious, but she sensed the faintest hint of teasing behind it.
I can't help it if I am shocked, my lord. Your arrogance is limitless after all,
Anne retorted.
As it should be, Cedric replied. Part of her wanted a nice vicious fight with him for his cheeky tone, but he wouldn't even give her that, the insufferable cad.
The coach came to a stop, and a footman dressed in the midnight blue and silver livery of the Duke of Essex opened the coach door on Cedric's side. Cedric took his cane, reached for the edges of the coach, and felt for the step. Anne noted that he was far more hesitant getting out than getting in. She couldn't help but wonder if he'd suffered a nasty fall from a coach recently. She could only imagine how painful that must have been, not to mention humiliating. Anne's stomach twisted in unease. How often had he hurt himself since last December? The memory of finding him in his gardens, hands bloodied, was one that haunted her. Even as he tormented her with his kisses and caresses, she could not hold her usual indifference or fury at him, like she could other men. Cedric had suffered like she had, and that fact bound them together now as kindred spirits.
Are you coming?
Cedric called out, offering his hand. She took it and let him help her down. Lifting her skirt, she walked with him toward the steps of the St. Laurent townhouse. To her dismay, he did not release her hand. It seemed he wished to embarrass her by such an obvious display of ownership of her person.
My lord, you must release my hand, she whispered, tugging to free herself.
Ashamed of me already, Anne?
Cedric replied rather loudly as the footman opened the door to the foyer for them. He did that so often, murmuring her name at the end of a question or a sentence, as though getting her used to the sound of him saying it. It had riled her before, but now she was growing accustomed to the honeyed way it rolled off his lips.
You know I am not. A gentleman would let me take his elbow, and I could assist in guiding you to the door,
she replied icily. But Cedric merely chuckled, as though her tone did not concern him at all.
I'll not trip. He waved his cane in front of them, tapping the stones. Relax, love. No one here tonight will judge us if we show outward affection for each other.
Is that what you call this? I would call it enforced imprisonment of my hand,
Anne hissed. But before she or Cedric could continue this line of conversation, Emily came out of the nearest room and hurried over with her husband, Godric, on her heels.
Anne!
Emily hugged her tightly, her young face shining with excitement.
It's so good to see you, Emily. Your Grace!
Anne dipped into a slight curtsy in Godric's direction, even though one of her hands was still firmly clasped in Cedric's. Godric beamed at her and nodded in greeting.
We are so glad that you could attend. Please, come this way.
Godric took Emily's arm and proceeded with Anne and Cedric back into the room from which they'd come. From the multitude of bodies and voices, she realized that she and Cedric had arrived last. The Earl of Lonsdale was leaning against the mantel of the fireplace, speaking to Godric's half-brother, Jonathan St. Laurent. Lord Lennox sat on a couch conversing with Horatia, Viscountess of Rochester. Her husband, Lucian, stood behind the couch, hands resting on his wife's shoulders in a gesture both affectionate and protective. The intimacy they displayed made Anne's heart stir with envy and sadness. Emily and Godric moved into the room, leaving Anne and Cedric standing in the doorway, exposed to the others. Anne moved instinctively closer to Cedric, her left arm brushing his, fingers tightening around his hand. She felt embarrassed and awkward being here in what was so obviously a strange sort of family built upon love, loyalty, and friendship, none of which she had a claim to other than with Emily.
What's the matter?
Cedric whispered, his concern touching her heart.
I just... What if they don't like me? Your friends, I mean. They barely know me.
Anne whispered back. You have Emily's friendship and approval. And what's more, you have mine. If they don't treat you kindly, then they will answer to me.
I didn't mean...
She didn't want to sound like she expected him to choose her over his friends, should it come to that. She would never want him to make that choice.
Please relax, and lead me to a chair, will you?
Anne got Cedric seated, and then took a chair next to his.
I believe congratulations are in order, Lord Ashton said.
He smiled at her, and the rest of the room followed suit in offering their excitement over the upcoming marriage. Anne's fears about being found wanting by Cedric's friends seemed to be ill-founded. She finally relaxed, letting out a sigh of relief. Cedric must have heard this and put his arm around the back of her chair, cupping the nape of her neck. She was about to protest when his thumb and forefinger began to rub up and down the sides, massaging the tense knot of muscles there. The sensation was divine, and it seemed to melt every bone in her body.
All will be well, he said, continuing to stroke her neck.
Anne blushed when she noticed Emily watching her and Cedric with avid interest. Emily led the group in the sitting room through polite small talk until the dinner bell rang. Everyone rose and headed for the dining room. Cedric offered his arm to Anne and she took it. It never ceased to amaze her how often they touched now. It seemed his body and hers were dancing in a slow spin around each other. And some day soon they would collide, and never again be fully separate in some mysterious and primal way. Anne's breath hitched in her throat at the thought. Even blind, Cedric was still a powerful masculine force that could easily dominate and possess her. She blushed deeply as she was reminded all that power and handsome perfection was hers now. But as much as the prospect thrilled her, it also frightened her out of her wits. What if he found her wanting? What if he found no pleasure in her bed and sought it in the arms of another?
How am I to keep him, if I cannot trust myself to surrender to him?
Chapter 5 Cedric was ignorant of his fiancée's thoughts as he walked with her to dinner. He let her body guide his, feeling the faint pull of her when he needed to alter his path.
It was a skill he'd worked on when Ashton led him about while he first learned to survive with his condition. Fortunately, he was decently familiar with Godric's townhouse, but the nervousness that held his body made him more hesitant than usual. He wanted to show Anne that he could still play the English gentleman, that he was not as helpless and hopeless as he felt. He sagged into his seat at the table with relief. His body seemed to naturally tense when he was up and about, as though some part of him expected to be injured somehow. Feeling more like himself, he reached out boldly to find his wine goblet. Splunk! His hand collided with the thin stem of the goblet, toppling it onto its side. He heard the wine sluice over the table, and the chatter around the table halted. Cedric, even blind, could sense every eye in the room fixed upon him. It was mortifying. The only relief was that he couldn't see the pity in their faces. It was too much. He hated eating in front of others, and this was why. Cedric shoved his seat back, which happened to hit a footman. The footman stumbled, dropping a replacement goblet, which shattered on the wooden floor close by. Cedric got to his feet and felt about for his cane, but it wasn't there. "Cedric," Godric said somewhere near his right. But Cedric shrugged off his friend's coaxing tone. With as much pride as he could muster, he walked in the direction of the door to leave the dining room. He didn't want to apologize. He didn't want to hear the pity in their voices. He needed solitude. Charles called after him. "Cedric, really, it's fine." But Cedric had already reached the door and propelled himself out into the hall. Hands outstretched, he summoned a map of Godric's house in his head and made for the library. At least, he hoped he was heading in that direction. Facing his friends was hard enough when he wasn't breaking costly crystal goblets. He'd been able to accept their help for the first few months, but by now he should have mastered his hands and legs, no longer creating such accidents. It was shameful, and he couldn't stand to receive any aid, not when he shouldn't need it any longer. Cedric muttered a curse when he tripped over the threshold of the library. He knew it was the library by the thick, musty scent of a multitude of books. He'd never been one for reading, but he'd grown fond of libraries since he'd lost his sight. With a library, he always knew where he was. Their unique aroma gave them away, and he felt comforted knowing exactly where he was in a house for a change. "I wish I had my cane," he said to the book-filled room. He usually kept it close to him, but he'd been more preoccupied with Anne and had forgotten where he'd placed it. It took him a few minutes of blundering about before he stopped hitting bookshelves and found a deep back settee to slump into. He lay back and rubbed his eyes, a useless gesture, but it was a habit he couldn't break. Cedric took a few deep, measured breaths, but his hands were still shaking. "Pull yourself together," he hissed at himself. There was a soft rap on the library door. Cedric didn't move. He heard slippered footsteps approaching him. The scent that teased his nose was flowery, but not the scent of wild orchids. It wasn't Anne. "Cedric!" Horatia sat down by him on the settee and laid her head on his shoulder, as she used to do when she was a child. Brotherly instinct took over, and he wrapped his arms about her, pulling her close to him in a tight hug. "Do you want to talk about it?"
"I have nothing much to say, my dear. I'm a pathetic creature who can't even dine with my friends. I'm sure Emily is devastated that I broke her fine crystal." Horatia laughed.
"She declared you did her a favour. She detested that crystal, and you gave her an excuse to dispose of the rest. She ordered the butler to have some footman take it all away after the meal is over. She seemed quite gleeful about it." Horatia's soft tone was full of amusement, and Cedric heard only truth in her voice. Still, Emily could just as easily have been putting on a show for his comfort when he later heard of it.
"And the others, how did they react?" he asked.
"They don't mind at all. We have all adjusted to what happened to you. Everyone but you, that is. What they mind is the way you think they won't accept you as you are now. None of us are perfect, and none of us expect you to be either. You have to stop pitying yourself, or I will get cross with you. And I do not want to be cross with my favourite brother."
"I'm your only brother,"
he cut in, with a grin tugging at the corners of his mouth. "A triviality," Horatia teased and kissed his cheek.
"Horatia?"
"Yes?"
"About your condition."
"The baby?" Horatia's tone held a hint of embarrassed surprise.
"I just wanted to say, well, that I'm overjoyed to be an uncle. And what's more, I'm glad that you and Lucien are happy. I've been such a fool. I nearly got all of us killed because I could not believe that people could change. But we can. I know that now. I've changed. Anne has changed. It seems we've always been changing, but have never been aware of it until now."
"Is it true that Anne asked you to propose to her?"
He patted his sister's shoulder, a smile on his lips. "Yes, it was an odd surprise, but not an unwelcome one."
"Well, I certainly like her, as does Emily. But are you sure you will be happy with her? I thought she had no interest in you."
How he loved his sister. She was always thinking of him, even when she shouldn't have to. "I thought so too at first. But something is different. She's become vulnerable since her father's death, and I couldn't refuse to play her white knight when she asked me to."
"But will she make you happy? Lucien worries she's too guarded to love anyone. But you deserve love, not just companionship."
It was the second time someone had told him that today, and he felt strangely warm inside, and yet guilty. He didn't deserve love. None of the League did. But if it came, and he could grasp it, he'd hold tight and never let go. "Don't worry, Horatia. I have ways of melting her icy walls," Cedric grinned. "In fact, if you could tell Emily that I'm still dreadfully embarrassed and would like to take my meal in here, could you see to it that Anne brings my food? I doubt that Anne would go along with a request more suited to a footman," Horatia cautioned. "Tell Emily that I insist Anne brings it."
"And just what, dearest brother mine, are you planning to do when she does?"
"You're married to Lucien, sweetheart. I'm sure that you have some idea how much fun sharing a meal can be."
"You devil!"
His sister's indignant tone was marred by a smothered giggle.
"Just do not rush her."
Horatia rose from the settee. She placed a kiss on his forehead and departed. Cedric grinned. The evening could still be salvaged with a bit of help from edible seduction. Anne squirmed in her seat as Horatia returned to the dining room. "Is everything well with him?" Ashton asked, all eyes fixed on her. Anne did not envy Cedric's sister having the attention of the room.
"He's a little embarrassed. He needs time to compose himself."
Horatia took her seat next to Lucien, before turning to Emily.
"Would it be possible to send him a plate of food and someone for company? I think he isn't ready to face everyone. But I believe he does not wish to be alone either." "Oh, certainly. I'd be happy to."
Emily started to rise, but Charles stopped her with an intense look. She plopped back down into her seat, her sweet face a picture of confusion. "Why doesn't Miss Chesley go? I mean, it seems with the upcoming wedding that perhaps the affianced couple would enjoy some private time together. Unless, of course, the lady does not wish to be burdened with the company of an ill-tempered blind man." It was a flat-out challenge. Anne frowned at those suddenly serious grey eyes. Now she saw the rogue in him, the seductive and dangerous man she'd had the fortune of avoiding since her coming out 5 years ago. It would take a strong woman to survive being the prey of that particular predator.
"I would be happy to share a private meal with Lord Sheridan."
Anne rose from the table, causing all the men to jump to their feet. She followed a stunned Emily out of the dining room, who instructed a waiting footman to bring two plates to the library before she turned to Anne, hands on her hips and violet eyes filled with concern.
"You don't have to dine with him, really, Anne. Charles is being an imbecile." "It's perfectly fine. I believe Lord Lonsdale is testing me. Despite the manner in which he delivered his opinion, I am honoured to be the subject of his challenge, because he demonstrated such loyalty to Lord Sheridan.
I would not wish to marry a man who did not have good taste in friends.
She meant every word. As much as it irked her to have to prove herself, she was glad to think Cedric had so many people watching over him. The two fell in step, walking leisurely to the library in order to give the staff time to prepare and catch up.
But still, Charles was far too rude, and I will not allow such impertinent behaviour inside my house.
Emily raised her chin angrily.
How far she has come,
Anne thought with pride. To be such a young debutante, and then a duchess half a year later. She played the part well, and would only get better at it.
Please, don't trouble yourself on my account. I would much rather prove Lord Lonsdale wrong by showing my dedication to my fiancé.
I still cannot believe you are marrying Cedric. I have my hopes, of course. Emily trailed off when Anne stopped short beside her.
What do you mean?
Well, for as long as I have known Cedric, he's asked me about you.
Heavens, he never stopped until...
There was no need to finish the sentence. Until the accident.
He talked about me,
Anne whispered, her throat tight.
He was so frustrated over your constant refusals to see him, to even speak to him, that he was going mad. You were always on his mind, and still are, it would seem.
Emily's soft voice was full of mystery, even knowledge about things Anne, even older than Emily, had yet to grasp. Anne had the sudden urge to tell Emily everything, to spill out the secret she'd been keeping inside her guarded heart for so long. But she couldn't trust herself not to falter. Emily had so much to handle as a duchess that Anne did not want to burden her friend with her own emotional nonsense. She must find her own way to persevere. Before the silence between them could stretch any further, Anne and Emily reached the library.
"He's in there?"
she asked. Emily nodded, just as the footman arrived with a silver tray and two plates of food.
"I left out any entrees that might pose problems for Lord Sheridan, such as the peas," the footman said discreetly to Emily.
"Thank you, Jim. I appreciate your consideration. Please take the meals inside and set up the main table."
"Yes, Your Grace."
Jim bowed his head and entered the library. When the footman had left, Emily turned her attention back to Anne.
"You really mean to marry him?"
"Yes." How many times would she have to defend her choice? Was it so impossible to think she actually wanted to marry Cedric?
"But will you be happy with him? Don't marry him unless you can promise me that you will be happy." "I will be happy. It may not be a happiness like yours, but I believe that marriage to Lord Sheridan will give me a sense of contentment I have not found before now."
Emily snorted.
"Contentment? Oh, Anne, I do not think you know Cedric as well as you think. He won't be satisfied until he's seduced you to the point that you won't remember your name. He loves a challenge. It is what keeps him going, especially these days."
Anne smiled.
"I am well aware of his love of challenges. I mean to give him one."
With that, she stepped into the library to find her fiancé. Cedric was leaning back against a scarlet velvet settee, with a dismal look on his face. Anne motioned for Jim to leave once he finished setting up the table.
"Is that you, Anne?"
Cedric cocked his head to the side. Anne had the strangest feeling that he'd recognized her by her scent.
"Yes, my lord. I've had dinner brought for us."
He seemed to hear her approach, and held up a hand to stay her.
"I'm blind, not an invalid,"
he snapped as he got to his feet. He was lucky he could not see the hurt those words had caused her. Cedric reached the nearest chair and pulled it out for her. He couldn't see his error. Her plate was a good few feet away from that seat, but she reached over the table and slid her plate toward the seat he offered.
"Please, sit,"
he said a little more cordially.
"Thank you."
Anne slid into the seat offered. He pushed her in a few inches before he pulled his own chair back with caution and seated himself next to her. Anne watched as he slid his hands along the table's surface until his fingertips bumped into the edge of his own plate.
"Ah, There we are, he said to himself, and drew the plate toward himself before hunting for the silverware. It struck Anne then that Cedric's loss of sight affected more than his vision. Every move he made was slow, measured, calculated to prevent injury to himself or damage to things around him. His muscles tensed and remained unbearably taut. His face seemed perpetually strained at the effort of reining in his movements. She couldn't forget the man he used to be, a man of power and strength, with a fearless swagger in his steps that was entirely gone now. His natural physical grace had been erased, like a stallion lamed. He would never regain the beautiful gait she'd once loved when she'd seen him dance. The fear of falling or striking something would forever mar his movements. Even now his face tightened with frustration as he floundered about for his silverware. Anne spoke up with a gentle voice. 6 inches to your right. She then sipped her wine and felt a fleeting sense of victory when he found his spoon. He ran a cautious thumb over its rounded edge and then grinned in her direction. May not be the best utensil, a spoon, but it's easier to work with than a fork. Cedric's casual remark made Anne choke on her wine. Beg pardon? With a fork, I spend half my meals trying to find the food, and the rest trying to get it into my mouth. Spoons are easier to use. I prefer forks only when I'm eating something that requires it to be held in place for cutting. Anne pictured Cedric trying to eat and finding each meal a source of constant frustration. It did not escape her notice now that he looked thinner, paler than he used to. Perhaps he wasn't getting enough food to eat because of how much trouble it was, or perhaps his melancholy spoiled his appetite. What a tragedy it was that he lost the bloom of his manhood to the slow wasting away of his condition. Blindness alone was not his enemy. It was losing the little pleasures of one's life, because they were now impossible to do. It was no wonder he had jumped on her offer of marriage. He needed something, or someone to focus on. Someone to break the despairing monotony of his current existence. Rather than feel good that she was offering him such a reprieve, Anne could not help but wonder if he was merely using her, the way he would have used any woman who asked him to marry her. Emily might be wrong about Cedric still wanting her. She was such a romantic, after all. Last year he'd been intent on seduction. The passion was there, the fire of his longing for her, even if only physical, and she'd been terrified of how she'd respond. But now his kisses, while just as hot, were tinged with desperation, and it upset her. As selfish as it was, she wanted him to kiss her because he wanted to kiss her, not because he had to feed his rakish need for contact with a woman's body. "I'm sorry if my conversation is not to your liking," Cedric said.
"What?"
Anne hadn't been listening and couldn't remember what he'd been speaking about. Cedric's head was turned in her direction, but his brown eyes were distant as always, and his usually sensual mouth was tightened into a grim line.
"Ah!" I've lost the ability to entertain a beautiful woman, it seems. I regret that I am not the man I once was. We could be having a very different evening together.
The ghost of his old smile flitted over his lips, as though he was reliving some of his more wicked moments with other ladies.
I am not beautiful, my lord, but your compliment is kind. I am enjoying our evening now. Please do not think I find your ability to entertain as lacking in any way.
Anne picked up a fork and began to slice the breast of her pheasant.
You think you are not beautiful?
Perhaps I'm not the only one who is blind in this room.
To me, you are a diamond.
Cedric's tone had lost its gruff defensiveness and become silky. Anne narrowed her eyes at him. Was he making fun of her? To compare her to a cold, sharp stone? Or was he trying to say she was costly? Neither of these comparisons was even remotely appealing.
Again, I've said something wrong, Cedric mused as he glided his spoon toward the lumpy mass of what Anne hoped was a fattening meat pie.
She wanted Cedric to eat more. His cheekbones were too gaunt, and his eyes too hollow. How had she not noticed this before?
Was her own self-absorption strong enough to blind her to his suffering?
"I'm sorry, my lord. I'm not in the best of moods for conversation."
"Is there nothing we might talk about?" Cedric asked, with genuine hope in his voice. He really did want to make things work between them, and for some reason it stung her with guilt that she had trapped him into marriage without warning him that she would not be so easy to seduce or even befriend.
"Have I wronged him already?"
she wondered silently. But there was no easy answer. Anne was silent for a moment before a question sprung to her lips.
"Emily says you won your Arabian mares from a sheik in a game of whist. Is that true?"
She couldn't contain the excitement in her voice. She wished very much to hear more about it. "Emily told you about that, did she?" Cedric grinned from ear to ear as he spooned a few big mouthfuls of pie into his mouth and swallowed.
"I would love to hear the full story, if you wouldn't mind sharing it with me."
Anne felt a little shy, but she did very much wish to hear the tale.
"It is true, I won the horses, but I shall tell you the true tale. I admit I rather censored the story with Emily. She was so innocent. I didn't wish to frighten her with tales of my recklessness, not while she was Godric's captive."
"What parts did you leave out?"
Anne leaned forward on her elbows, curiosity holding her in its thrall.
"Well, there was much more to the wager than a pair of horses and money. And the sheik was not actually a sheik, but a very rich Arabian merchant who specialized in slavery."
"Slavery? Of people?"
His face darkened. "Oh, yes. He was a charming but evil bastard, and powerful. The sort who has equally powerful friends who allowed him to get away with almost anything. Almost." A look of danger and wildness suddenly gave this conversation a new edge she hadn't anticipated.
"And what did you really wager with him?"
Her question came out a little breathless. Cedric smiled rakishly in her direction before replying.
"His horses, for my freedom."
Chapter 6.
"Charles, I want a private word with you immediately."
The Duchess of Essex tapped her foot and pointed to the door. Charles rose from his chair, and the others at the table looked away in various directions. No one would save him from Emily's wrath, it seemed. Cowards. He shouldn't have challenged Anne. He realized his mistake now. But if Emily was going to lecture him, he'd not make it easy for her.
"Today, if you please,"
Emily commanded. With an exaggerated sigh, Charles followed her into the hallway, where she turned and punched him in the chest with a little balled fist. She moved to strike him again, but Charles blocked the blow with his forearm, acting so instinctively that he didn't even realize he'd moved. The pugilist in him always managed to rise to the surface, it seemed. He grabbed her delicate wrist before she could assault him a third time. He was so annoyed that she'd resorted to striking him that he kept her wrist locked in his grasp.
"What is it that has upset you, my dear?"
He tried to sound patient, but his voice was low in warning.
"You! Your behavior! How dare you say such things to Anne? She's my friend, and you are a guest in this household. I will not tolerate you threatening her or holding my arm against my will like this."
Charles uncurled his fingers, and Emily snatched her wrist back, rubbing the reddened marks on her fair skin with a scowl.
"Apologies," he muttered, "but I did not threaten her."
"It certainly sounded as though you did. You challenged her about her choice to marry Cedric. To a woman in love, that is a threat."
"And how do you know she is in fact in love with him? I've seen no proof."
"Why do you care if she loves him or not?" Emily asked.
Charles turned his face away, studying the blue and white patterned wallpaper as though the answer to her question lay there.
"Why do you care?" Emily repeated.
"Why? Damn it all, Emily, it's because of you."
He regretted the words the moment he said them. Now he'd never hear the end of it. Emily's eyes went wide.
"What do you mean?"
"You've changed everything. Don't you see?
Ever since we abducted you, nothing has been the same. We've lost what made us strong. You've single-handedly crippled the League of Rogues. Godric is a fool for love. Lucien and Cedric fought a duel over a woman. Cedric is blind. Ashton is more melancholy than I've ever seen him. Bloody Hugo Waverley seems to lurk behind every dark shadow trying to ruin us. And I can't seem to wake from this living nightmare of perpetual fear. We've been ruined. Ruined by you.
He punctuated these sharp words by driving his fist against the wall. Emily stepped back in alarm. Charles stopped and bent his forehead to the wall as he drew in a deep, steadying breath. He'd never hit a woman. Would never hit a woman. But sometimes punching a wall eased the tension in him.
I've ruined you.
Emily's voice trembled. But Charles would not look her way, not for all the tea in China. He could not bear to see her cry, which was exactly the point he'd tried to make. The League of Rogues shouldn't be capable of being felled by a young woman's tears. They couldn't afford to have that weakness, not if they were to survive. The events that led to Cedric's blindness had been but a warning of what was yet to come. If only she knew Hugo the way he did.
Everything is different. I expect things now. Things I'd never dared to dream about before. What if my dreams fail? What if I do not deserve what I hunger for? Yes, I blame you for that.
Out of the corner of his eye, he saw Emily's hands move about her face, as though to dispel any evidence of her tears. Damnation. He didn't want to be talking to her about this. He didn't even want to be thinking about this. Emily put her hand on his shoulder.
What do you dream about? What do you fear you'll never have?
Charles shut his eyes. For a long moment he considered not answering her and keeping his thoughts private. But Emily had this awful way of getting inside his head and making him want to bare his soul to her.
I want an end to my nightmares, and a woman who loves me so deeply that my heart will be fit to burst. Godric and Lucien have that. But what if I cannot? What if I don't deserve such a thing?
There it was. He wanted love. He was a fool, and the angels would mock him for it.
How could you ever think you don't deserve to be loved, Charles?
There are things about us even you don't know, Emily.
She waved the notion away.
Nonsense. Your heart is loyal and true. As are those of your friends. And if I have to take Ashton's fleet of ships and sail them to the ends of the earth to find someone who loves you, I will. You will have such joy that your heart won't be able to contain it, so it will overflow into everything and everyone around you. I know that this dream can become a reality, but it requires patience. Can you be patient for me?
Emily asked. Charles's answer was to turn and pull her into him, hugging her tight. It never ceased to amaze him how she could turn him into a child. She made him feel safe, cared for, and yet she was a full decade younger than he was. Godric was a lucky man. Drawing in a deep breath, he answered,
I can be patient. I can.
Emily tried to speak, but her voice was muffled by his waistcoat.
Pardon?
He asked her, as he pulled back. With a little dramatic inhale of breath, she looked up at him.
Are you still angry with me?
I could never stay mad at you for long, my dear, Charles said, before he kissed her cheek and released her. You go back into dinner. I'll be along shortly. I just need a minute.
She focused on the worried expression he wore on his face.
Are you sure?
Yes. On with you now. He shooed her away.
Once Charles was alone, he crept toward the partially open library door. Inside, he saw Anne with her back to him. She was politely directing Cedric as to where to find his spoon. Their conversation was awkward for a time before she asked about Cedric's horses and his famous wager. Cedric grinned, happy to tell the story, and she leaned toward him with open curiosity. Charles saw no love yet between his friend and Anne, but he did see hope. perhaps for the first time since Cedric had lost his sight. Charles swallowed the tight lump in his throat, then backed away to avoid disturbing the occupants of the library. He did not return to the dining hall, but instead sat down on the second-to-last step of the main staircase, elbows on his knees. He buried his face in the shelter of his palms. He did not look up immediately at the sound of boots coming down the stairs. A hand rested lightly on his right shoulder, and only then did he face the person who had stumbled upon him in his emotionally ravaged state. It was his newest servant, the lad Tom Linley.
"Everything all right, my lord?"
Linley's eyes were filled with concern, his blonde hair a mess of tangles beneath his flat cap. Linley was an odd boy, quiet to the point of being timid. Charles suspected that the boy had seen serious abuse at the hands of a former master. But Linley always turned up whenever Charles felt the most alone. It was as though the lad had a sixth sense for when his master needed companionship. Though he claimed he was 20, Charles suspected he was much younger. Linley had been decently educated because his mother had been a lady's maid to the mother of an earl, and he raised his baby sister all on his own since his mother's death. With half the league either married or engaged, Linley had become indispensable to him, a companion so crucial to his daily life that he felt like a part of Charles's family, as much as any servant could.
"I'm fine, lad, truly. It has been a long day, that is all."
Charles raked a hand through his hair and let out a shaky breath.
"It is true, my lord," Linley said after a quiet moment.
"What is?" he asked, perplexed.
"That you have a heart worthy of love. Her grace is right. Some day a woman will love you, and you will be happy. It's the way of things."
"Don't tell me you are the romantic sort," Charles teased and shoved the boy's shoulder. The boy flashed a rare grin, and Charles marvelled at the change such a smile had on the boy's face. The worry and fear that often lurked there simply vanished.
"You ought to smile more, Linley. The ladies will be beating down your door," Charles advised.
Linley blushed.
"No time for that, my lord. I already get far too much exercise chasing after you, if you take my meaning.
That is a most grueling and consuming task in itself."
"Why, you cheeky little—"
Charles reached over, feigning to strangle the lad, but they both burst into laughter.
"I suppose it is. I can't seem to sit still for more than an hour's time. There's too much to do. Women to bed, horses to race, men to box. Sleeping is for the dead."
Linley smiled again, and a pleasant silence settled between them.
"I suppose I ought to return to dinner, otherwise Emily will send a search party for me, and I'll have to bear her scorn a second time."
Charles got to his feet.
"I shall send a footman to collect you when I wish to have the carriage pulled around."
As Charles walked back toward the dining hall, Tom Linley remained seated on the stairs. A smile, unguarded, curved his lips, then slowly dropped into a frown.
"You wagered your freedom against the Sheik's horses?"
Anne asked, as Cedric paused to finish the last bit of his dinner. He moved to stand.
"Indeed."
"I don't believe you."
"It does not require your belief to be true," he said, passing her by.
"Aren't you going to tell me what really happened?"
"If you would join me on the settee, then I shall."
Anne rose to her feet as well and moved toward him.
"And if I don't?"
Anne returned cautiously. She had every intention of joining him, but wanted to see just how much he was up to the challenge of wooing her. Emily was right. Cedric needed a challenge to keep him interested.
"Then your curiosity must forever go unsatisfied."
Cedric felt his way over to the settee, and then seated himself. Anne was on the verge of smiling or snorting at his arrogance. She wasn't sure which.
"You believe my curiosity is that strong? Do you claim to know me so well?"
Cedric smirked.
"Only a dim-witted fool would not desperately want to know how I escaped the clutches of an evil slave trader and returned victorious with a pair of the man's best horses. And you, my lovely diamond, are anything but a fool.
You cannot resist knowing how I avoided a nasty fate, such as a eunuch for an Arab's harem. As Cedric spoke, Anne drifted closer and closer to the settee, until she surprised herself by sliding into the space left open next to him. Like a foal lured with the promise of sugar cubes, she waited eagerly for him to share the rest of his tale.
A eunuch? Oh, please, tell me the rest.
She didn't even realize she was tugging his sleeve like a spoiled child until he seized her. Cedric wrapped a possessive arm around her waist and dragged her onto his lap. Anne fought off the panic at their sudden proximity, but when his muscles tensed around her, she ceased, giving up the fight.
"You really do love to humiliate me, don't you, Lord Sheridan?"
She settled herself on his lap, then jerked violently after feeling a particularly stiff part of his anatomy directly beneath her.
"Christ, woman, easy, or I won't be able to demand my marital rights."
Cedric eyed her askance before adding,
"Maybe that's what you want, you little hellion."
"Don't be ridiculous. I'm just not used to."
She waved a hand helplessly at his lap.
"That thing making an appearance."
"You've a lot to learn about men. That thing, as you call it, will be making many appearances. And as my wife, you'll be attending to it, just as I will be attending to your needs."
He leaned close to her, his long brown eyelashes fanning out as his sightless eyes seemed to search in vain for a glimpse of her lips.
"Would you do something for me, Anne, darling?"
he asked. He'd called her many endearments, but "Anne, darling" seemed to stir something deep inside her.
"That depends. Will it involve something I shall regret?"
"Just nibble your bottom lip for a brief moment."
"What? Why?"
"Please."
His hands on her back moved slowly up and down in a soothing motion.
"Very well."
Anne found herself doing as he asked, nibbling her lower lip and watching his responding smile, his blind gaze still lowered.
"Now why did I just do that?"
she asked, as Cedric shut his eyes, an expression of pain and bliss all at once on his face.
"I wanted to picture you with pink, swollen lips, as though I'd just kissed you until you couldn't breathe.
I could see it so clearly when I closed my eyes.
Most women have faded in my mind, but not you. Never you."
Goosebumps broke out over Anne's skin. She bit her lip to stifle a wistful sigh that his words could ever be true. She was the only woman who wouldn't fade in this blind man's mind. It couldn't be possible, yet she wished it was. Trying to change the subject, she spoke again.
"Was this a ruse to lure me onto your lap, or will you tell me the story? Perhaps there is no story to tell."
"Of course there is a story, my heart. I assure you that my desire to lure you into my embrace was entirely secondary in importance to satisfying your curiosity."
Anne's heart's tempo shot up when he called her "my heart." She knew logically that he, like any rake, threw such sweet endearments out frequently and meant nothing by them. She couldn't help but wonder if each pet name he came up with would continue to move her until she was half in love with him. Cedric nuzzled her cheek, moving down to her throat. Anne shifted on his lap as a wave of lust uncoiled in her belly. She could not give in to his seduction or lose her heart to him. It would devastate her when he would not be willing or able to love her back as she feared.
"So, what happened?"
she persisted.
Cedric sighed in disappointment. "You are very determined this evening, aren't you?"
He moved his face back, his unseeing eyes aimed several inches to the left of her face.
"I am when you tease me with a tale of Arab slave traders, horses, and harems."
"Very well. I shall satisfy your curiosity. But know this, you will satisfy me when I come to you with my own desires."
Anne said nothing, forcing herself to regain control before any unbidden images of Cedric and his desires took hold of her focus.
"It was a warm evening in March of last year. Ashton and I were at Barclays for the night,
playing cards with a friend.
Chapter 7. London, March 1820. Cigar smoke hung in hazy clouds near the ceiling of Barclay's dimly lit card room. The majority of men lounging in chairs about the card tables were in their mid to late 30s. The young, sensible bucks of marrying age were enslaved at the dances of Almack's that evening. Only the most dangerous of men were left free to prowl tonight and seek their pleasures, without worry of crossing the paths of society mamas and their marriage-minded daughters. Cedric, Ashton, and their friend, James Fordyce, the Earl of Pembroke, chose a table near the main fireplace to play a few games of whist before heading to a pleasure haunt in a few hours. Ashton spread the deck of cards out and shuffled them, while Cedric and James flagged down a club servant to bring 3 glasses of port.
"Thank God Letty did not expect me to accompany her to Almack's," James confessed to Cedric.
James blew out a sigh of relief. Cedric chuckled at the relieved expression in the Earl's eyes.
"Not a lover of the quadrilles, Pembroke?" Ashton asked.
James laughed.
"When a man reaches 28, he shouldn't have to suffer escorting his sister to such events. I argue that it is a matter of principle to excuse myself from such abominable dances and pointless flirtations."
"Isn't your mother expecting you to choose a bride soon?" Cedric asked.
"Yes, but I don't want to marry just any chit. Any woman at Almack's tonight is not a woman I want to marry," Cedric snorted.
"Then my sisters are safe. What a relief that is."
"I would not wish to be there either," Ashton mused. "In fact, I feel quite guilty because I forced my brother into taking Joanna tonight." Rafe was not pleased. But when Thomasina and I pushed on him, he caved.
"It's been a few years since Joanna came out, hasn't it?" James asked, sipping his brandy.
"Yes, bless her heart. She'll be 22 in a month, and no man has come around asking for her. I can't understand why. I've been most encouraging to any man who has even so much as asked for her to pass the salt at dinner engagements. But it's no use. Not one man has shown he's even remotely interested."
Ashton sighed and thumbed through his cards. Cedric was only half listening to this. Talk of marriage and sisters always put him on edge. He didn't like thinking of his own sisters marrying. Ashton's older sister, Thomasina, was already married with a passel of children, but Joanna was the baby of Ashton's family, and her brother was apparently determined to see her wed.
"What? No suitors?" James exclaimed in surprise. "Joanna is such a lovely girl."
Ashton shrugged. "Thomasina believes that she's too likable as a companion, not a woman. She has many men who admire her wit and humour, yet none of them so much as send a bouquet of flowers.
Damned if I can figure out why. She has a sizable dowry, and I've not hidden that fact from any man."
"Men are fools," Cedric announced grimly.
"So, how is Letty?"
Ashton inquired as he began to deal the deck between the three of them.
"Spoiled is what? Last week she told me that a genteel lady ought to own at least 12 pairs of gloves. I dared to ask what was the use of so many gloves in the spring, and she fairly bit my head off. She used some French words I've never even heard of,"
James remarked with pensive amusement.
Cedric chuckled. "The fascination with fashion I once believed to be restricted to the fairer sex, but unfortunately I've seen far too many dandies prowling the streets who are arrested by the splendid sight of themselves reflected in a shop's window glass. A bunch of popinjays, the lot of them."
Cedric sipped his port as he eyed one such colourfully dressed dandy who was chatting with a foreign-looking gentleman who had just entered the room.
"I say, Pembroke, do you know that man there?"
Cedric gestured to the foreigner.
"Freddy Ponsonby?"
James asked, shooting a scathing glance over his shoulder at the dandy who was waving his arms excitedly as he spoke. Ponsonby was not a favourite of any gentleman at their table. He was a tad too cowardly, and there was a touch of weasel in him that Cedric didn't trust.
"No,
The other gentleman. Oh, why, that's Samir al-Zarani. He's from Nejd in Arabia.
Al-Zarani? Cedric eyed the man curiously. He was tall, with deeply olive skin, and a harsh but handsome face and form. Dark brows swept over a pair of black eyes that scanned the room with a militaristic precision that stirred Cedric's curiosity.
I heard he is a wealthy merchant, which, given the power struggles and political upheavals in that part of the world, is quite a feat.
A merchant of what?
James, a seasoned rake, who had little occasion to act self-conscious of delicate matters, actually looked flustered.
That depends on who you ask. Most people will tell you he deals in textiles, but I've heard that he runs another far more lucrative business on the side. Slave-based.
James uttered this last in a soft tone. Ashton and Cedric exchanged surprised looks.
Slaves?
Ashton's tone was heavy with disapproval. Parliament had outlawed the slave trade over a decade before, though slavery was sadly still legal abroad, though not on English soil, as William Cowper had once said.
Slaves cannot breathe in England. If their lungs receive our air, that moment they are free. They touch our country, and their shackles fall. That's noble, and bespeaks a nation proud.
Sadly, not all within the nation held such nobility.
Yes, I heard he has recently begun to offer his wares at various brothels in London. But that isn't nearly as frightening as the rumours that he's come here to take our own English roses back to Nejd with him to fill his markets there. Rumour has it such a prize will be worth 10 times what he makes elsewhere.
What? Cedric sat up straight in his chair.
That's nonsense, Pembroke. Someone would know if our ladies started vanishing, and that would raise an alarm.
He slapped his cards down, momentarily losing interest in the game.
It would be an act of war, Ashton agreed.
It is the truth, I tell you. I heard several members of the House speaking about it last week, out of session, of course. His father is a foreign emissary, and a powerful merchant in his own right. If he did try such a bold move, he might even get away. It might take too long to rally the navy to chase him down. I've been keeping Letty on a short leash ever since that man made his presence known in London. James looked entirely too serious, as though he'd been giving the matter a great deal of thought. Ashton leaned back in his chair and placed his cards face down on the table.
Be at ease, Pembroke. No doubt if such things were on his mind, he's been warned off by those very men you spoke of. Nothing like shining a light to chase away the shadows. And should Letty go missing, and you need a fleet of ships, you'll have mine to hunt the man down.
Thank you, Lennox, James replied. I think I should like to meet this man.
Cedric, Ashton warned. We have enough enemies at the moment.
Cedric grinned. Who said anything of enemies? Let's invite him to play whist.
Cedric did love to play with fire, even at the risk of being burned.
Cedric called out to Freddy and the foreigner.
Freddy, won't you and your friend join us for cards? We're about to indulge in a high-stakes game.
The foppish Freddy Ponsonby, a man of only 22, fairly ran to their table in excitement. The mysterious Samir al-Zarani on his heels. A pair of tall, dark-haired men flanked the trader on either side. Guards, Cedric assumed.
I say, gents, what a top-notch idea. Have you met Mr. Samir al-Zarani? Mr. al-Zarani, this is Cedric Sheridan, Viscount Sheridan. James Fordyce, the Earl of Pembroke. And Ashton Lennox, Baron Lennox.
It is a pleasure, gentlemen.
Al-Zarani's voice was a rich baritone, heavily accented, but his English was beyond reproach. Cedric and the others rose from their card table and greeted him. Then, with a little jerk of his head, Cedric indicated a door behind them.
What do you say we move to a private room?
With murmurs of agreement, the group moved to an enclosed chamber and closed the door. There would be no way they could be watched or overheard.
Have a seat,
Cedric offered with a devilish grin. When Ashton met his gaze, he rolled his eyes, no doubt realizing the night was not going to end as peaceably as it had begun.
Do you ever play whist, Mr. Alzerani?
Cedric eyed his target with a knowing smile. The idea of cleaning out a slave trader's pockets made his body tense with anticipation. He detested slavery, and if robbing this fellow blind put a dent in his pockets, he'd do it in a heartbeat.
I have played a few times,
Alzerani answered as he took his seat next to Freddy. Ashton quickly collected the cards and reshuffled them before dealing them out. The five men played three hands. Cedric played carelessly at first, losing two hands early on. As the game progressed, port was consumed liberally by all except Alzerani, who did not wish to indulge.
I say, Alzerani, you wouldn't happen to have heard of a horse called Firestorm. I believe that's his English name,
Cedric asked, his voice smooth and relaxed, thanks to the port. Firestorm was a purebred Arabian stallion, who was worth a fortune and rumoured never to have left Arabia. Nor was the horse permitted to be bred with any foreign breed. No Englishman had been able to get his hands on any of his offspring.
Firestorm, indeed I have, Lord Sheridan. That horse belongs to my father. I have two mares that are 1 and 3 years old that were sired by him.
Do you really?
Cedric sighed wistfully.
I would kill to see such a fine bit of horse flesh. I have them here in England, should you care to see them. It would be an honour.
Alzerani offered this with an air of smug pride in his dark eyes. It was obvious he was the sort who loved to flaunt his possession of something others coveted.
I just might, Cedric mused, and resumed playing his hand.
After six more hands, James and Freddy declined to continue, but remained to watch Ashton, Cedric, and Alzerani play for increasingly higher stakes. Cedric was flushed with the alcohol of the port and the excitement of the plan he was about to set in motion.
I wager £800 I can win this hand. No man ever beats me when I'm on a streak.
Cedric slurred a little as he downed the last of his port and grinned at Alzerani. The Arab watched him speculatively, then gave a dark smile that Cedric ignored entirely.
The thing about a streak is that it must inevitably end, my friend. Let us make a wager on something more valuable. How would my pair of mares suit you?
Alzerani tossed out casually. Cedric pretended to consider the offer.
And my forfeit? Perhaps I send you my mistress for the duration of your stay in London. Lovely bit of flesh she is. Knows her place, too. She'll treat you well on her back, like any woman should.
He waited, seeing if Alzerani would take the bait.
One of your women...
Alzerani, brooding, stroked the back of his cards, which lay on the table. He studied Cedric, as if realizing what was truly being insinuated by his offer.
While that intrigues me, I sense it would be no great loss to you.
With a huff, Cedric reached for his drink again.
Two women, then. I suppose I could find another quickly enough. Alas, no. If anything, you are only proving my point. Clearly my horses are worth more than a dozen of your English women. Well, then, what would satisfy you?
I engage in a special sort of trade, and I would have great use of you as a servant in my house to guard my precious wares.
A viscount? As a servant? Good God, man, you are bold. Just what is it that I would be guarding, and for how long?
As he spoke, Alzerani's guards shifted on their feet by the door, making sure no one could enter or leave.
You would be positioned as a guard for my female wares. Of course, you would need to be rendered harmless in order to ensure the females go untouched.
Cedric smirked.
Some sort of chastity belt, I take it.
I'm afraid we are a little more permanent with our solution to the problem.
Cedric heard a round of gulps from the other men at the table.
You'd make me a eunuch? Is that what you're saying? I mean, I do understand women aren't nearly as valuable as a good horse, but still, a man's parts are his parts.
It was a bluff. Al-Zarani had to be counting on him backing down from such a wild proposition. Cedric felt a flash of panic at the thought of castration, for a number of reasons. As the last male heir to the title in his family, he had a duty to bear a son, and the thought of never again being able to bed a woman was a bleak notion. Despite his bluster aimed at luring Al-Zarani into this bet, he valued the company of a good woman more than 100 of the finest horses.
Do not tell me that you are afraid to lose. I thought Englishmen were fearless.
Al-Zarani was still smiling, but darkness reflected in his eyes.
Me? Afraid? Why, that's absurd. I merely hesitate, as any decent man would when threatened with slavery and the removal of his manhood,
Cedric retorted. There was a murmur of agreement from his friends. Ponsonby noticeably cupped his hands over his groin. You do realize there is no slavery on English soil, Ashton interjected. Cedric shot him a look.
Damn it, man! Don't interfere!
It would not be slavery, and you would not be on English soil. As a matter of honor, you would willingly leave with me to my home country, and once there, remain under my employ, indefinitely. Which was just a fancy way of saying the same thing. Well, shall we agree to the terms and finish the hand? Al-Zarani asked. Cedric slanted his cards up from the table, eyeing his hand.
I'm not entirely sure my freedom is worth a pair of horses, Cedric said.
I can promise you, Lord Sheridan, the horses are worth the freedom of 100 men, and even one Viscount.
Still, the man had that inherent smugness.
Cedric, be wise about this,
Ashton said softly. Cedric met the gaze of his close friend, and for a moment he was fully sober, fully in command of himself.
I'm as wise as the day I met you,
Cedric replied, to which his friend almost burst out laughing. Ashton really should have learned by now to trust him on matters of risk. The night Cedric and Ashton had first met was the night they had saved Charles from being drowned by Hugo Waverley. They'd been aided by Lucien and Godric, and that night the League had been formed. Cedric had been the calmest during that harrowing rescue, which no doubt had helped save Charles's life. They had only failed in one thing that night. Another man had been the first to try and save Charles from Hugo, and he'd paid the price for his bravery. His death haunted the League still, and it was the reason Hugo had damned them all that night.
Very well. Ashton laid his cards down, signalling his withdrawal.
Then we have a wager, my lord?
Al-Zarani asked. Cedric flashed him a mad grin.
We do.
Both men revealed their hands, and Cedric snickered in triumph. Everyone but Ashton exclaimed in wonder at Cedric's winning hand.
When shall I come by and collect my mares?
Cedric asked with a satisfied smile, like a cat fattened on a canary. Al-Zarani spat, throwing his cards down and leaping to his feet.
You cheated! There was no way I could have lost. It was a mathematical impossibility.
Cedric scoffed. Me? A cheat? Nonsense. I played a decent hand of whist. Any Englishman could have done that.
He crossed his arms over his chest and leaned back in his chair, not at all perturbed by the fury of the Arabian merchant.
I will not give you my horses. I refuse.
Al-Zarani shouted with such loathing that poor Freddy Ponsonby dove under the nearest card table for cover. Ashton sighed at the sight of Freddy's green and white striped trousered bottom peeping out from under the table's edge.
"I played fair with you, Alzarani. Every man here saw the game. I won, and you owe me your forfeit. Lest your business associates in England learn of your unwillingness to honour a debt. Don't tell me you are the one who's afraid."
Cedric finally stood, but the action was a leisurely uncoiling of his strong athletic frame. The others stepped back, giving Cedric and Alzarani plenty of room to handle themselves, should they come to blows. After an intense duel of stares, the merchant backed down.
"So be it. I will have them sent to your residence in the morning. Enjoy them while you can. Justice ultimately arrives to men such as you. When that day comes, I will walk over your grave, have my horses back, and laugh last,"
Alzarani declared. "Don't flatter yourself. I've never expected to live long or peacefully. If you want revenge for an honest game of cards, then you best get in line, because I've done much worse to much better men, and they have more of a right to kill me than you."
"This is not the end between us, Lord Sheridan."
"Yes, it is. Either call me out, or walk away with your heart still beating." Alzarani glared at Cedric before leaving with his guards. Once he was gone, Ashton and Cedric resumed their seats along with James. "You chaps really play for keeps," the Earl of Pembroke muttered with a strained smile. "Of course we do," Cedric shot him a devil-may-care grin. Ponsonby, you can come out now." Ashton nudged the tip of his Hessian boot against the striped rump of the cowering dandy. Freddy emerged, looking embarrassed, his face scarlet to the roots of his fashionably cut brown hair.
"Well, if you will excuse me, I've had enough excitement for one night."
Freddy bid the others adieu, and practically sprinted for the door. There was a loud crash and shriek as a servant boy was run over by Freddy making his exit from Barclays. Cedric smothered a laugh. What good luck to finally have two purebred Arabian mares with pedigrees worth a fortune. Now only if he could find a decent stallion to breed them with. Anne focused on Cedric's face, secretly enjoying the wealth of emotions that flitted across his features as he told her the story.
"You don't think the Arab will return for you, do you?"
Cedric smiled. "He left London shortly after he delivered the mares to me. He simply had to make a show of pride before he left, and I had to respond in kind. It is the way of things when the stakes are so high." He showed more animation than she'd seen from him since he'd gone blind. For a brief few minutes, he'd been the old Cedric again, the one who... Anne shook her head, dispelling thoughts of the past, thoughts that stung too deeply.
"You men and your pride. Is there nothing else that matters to you?"
Cedric's deep laugh poured over her.
"Oh, my dear, you bait me with your innocence by asking that."
"What do you mean?"
Cedric cupped her chin and tilted his head down in reply, finding her lips with ease. Anne stiffened as his tongue traced the seam of her lips. Her hands fisted against his chest, as she went rigid in his lap. Cedric pulled his mouth away to whisper, "Don't forget what you promised, Anne. Don't turn to ice in my arms, love." He brushed his nose against her cheek. "Please, my heart, don't shut me out." His coaxing words tugged her down the slope of desire. It was more than lust, more than carnal craving. She might have been able to stop herself, to keep herself from surrendering, if he hadn't dipped his mouth to her neck and nipped her skin, following it with a slow, teasing lick. The sharp but light sting of his teeth sent a wave of pleasure through her. Anne lost control and melted in his lap. Cedric growled low as she let herself go limp in his arms and trembled at his kisses. He reached out to the side of the settee, gauging the distance to the other side before he slowly tilted Anne back to lie beneath him. He slid her skirts upward, pushing them into a pool around her hips. Then he palmed her knees, before gently nudging them apart. She should have clamped her thighs together, but instead she threw her head back and let her knees fall apart. Cedric stroked his hand along her inner thigh, then bent her leg up. She moved with him, understanding that she needed to offer a cradle for his trim hips. She dropped her other leg off the edge of the settee, giving him ample room to lower himself down between her thighs. The intimacy of their position was unbearable. Her breasts rose and fell with her soft, rapid panting. Trapped beneath him, she was at his mercy, and did not mind as much as she should have. It seemed only natural that her hand should fall on his shoulders and glide under the tight-fitting jacket, peeling it off his body. He shrugged the coat loose and dropped it to the floor. She couldn't find it in herself to care that they might actually. She blushed a little, unable to even think the words.
"Right here, in the library."
Cedric bent his head, his lips seeking any part of Anne that he could reach. She gasped when he reached the soft swell of the tops of her breasts and rained kisses down upon them. He was eager to delve beneath her bodice, to taste the pearl tips of those nipples, but reminded himself to slow down. He wouldn't bed his future wife in the library of his friend's house. Well, at least, not a woman like Anne. She deserved far better than that for her first time. He didn't want to rush their lovemaking, not when he knew it would hurt her. But he could give her a taste of what was yet to come. Cedric rolled his hips hard against hers, grinding his erection against the silk of her underpinnings. Anne arched off the settee with a startled moan, pressing herself against him. Cedric's lips trailed back up her throat to her mouth, to nibble on her bottom lip until she whimpered. She seemed entirely unaware of the little sound she made. Her inner wanton woman was in full control, and not just of her. Each sound, each shift of her body, wreaked havoc on his sanity. And then she spoke.
"Ah, the Arabian mares here in London."
Her voice was breathless, and Cedric rubbed himself harder against her, wanting her silent, save for cries of pleasure. But he fought off a smile when she struggled again to repeat her question. His woman certainly did love horses. "No, they're in Brighton." He nuzzled her neck before biting down hard without warning, like a lion holding his female still for mating. She gasped in surprise, her fingers digging into his shoulders, clawing him, not to release her, but to hold him to her body. Cedric felt ready to roar. He'd found her weakness, that smooth, delicious neck. Every woman had a secret spot that would drive them wild, make them senseless. Men had fewer such spots, obviously, but as a rake, Cedric had learned early on that finding a woman's pleasure point was the key to success, both for her enjoyment and his own. Having found Anne's, he would be merciless.
"Brighton? Why Brighton?"
"Damn, the woman still has enough sense to talk. I've been out of practice too long."
Cedric sank his teeth into the skin between her neck and shoulder, his hands sliding along her sides, then up under her skirts to cup her bottom. He jerked her into him as he rocked himself ferociously against her. Anne twitched and trembled with violent shivers, murmuring a startled exclamation he couldn't hear over the roaring of the blood in his ears. Damnation! The woman would be his undoing with her natural sensuality.
"Never enough. I'll never get enough of her."
Cedric caught Anne's lips with his, invading the silken recesses of her mouth, questing for her timid tongue. Every touch, every stroke, every delicious sensation and taste was all he had in the darkness, but it was glorious. Anne was glorious. Experiencing such passion as this with her was different from anything he'd ever expected. How was it possible that it was better than even his darkest fantasies had promised?
"Never enough."
Cedric tensed with his own need to come as Anne climaxed beneath him. Caged in by his arms, she shook with the aftermath of the moment, and then buried her face in the groove of his neck. The intimate gesture, the silent communication, warmed his entire body with something that had nothing to do with the physical pleasure he'd just experienced. Her hot breath, coming out in tiny pants, only heightened the pain in his groin. He would have none of his own pleasure, not tonight. But this was progress. He'd achieved the feat of truly pleasuring her, something he was certain no man before him had ever accomplished. There was a primitive sense of satisfaction from knowing that he was her first in that regard. Cedric eased his weight off her. "Are you all right, my heart?" He could feel her start to pull away, but he caught her waist and tugged her against him as they both sat up.
"I don't know. Is that how... does it always?"
Anne seemed unable to find the right words. He could only imagine the confusion she must have felt at experiencing a climax for the first time. La petite mort could be frightening, but also exciting for a young lady who didn't know what to expect, or so he'd been told. "If done properly, then yes. And I do believe I know what I'm doing when it comes to this sort of thing." Cedric wished he could have seen her face. It was the one thing he'd loved most when in bed with a woman. There was something stunning about how a woman's face lit up with ecstasy and joy as she came apart in his arms. "I will never see such joy on Anne's face."
"What if someone had come upon us?" Anne asked,
her body stiffening in his loose hold. "They didn't, and even if they had, we are engaged, and in a week we will be man and wife, and it will no longer matter. Besides, no one under this roof would judge us." Cedric brushed his knuckles over her cheek. Anne leaned away from his touch. That one small action sliced his heart. Would she always pull away from him? He could not marry a woman who fought him at every turn. He wanted, no, he needed someone who would not shy away from his touch. Cedric dropped his hand with a heavy sigh and let go of her waist.
"You should go. I wish to be alone."
Anne didn't move.
"Please, leave me,"
he said more loudly.
"Why?"
Her surprise sounded genuine.
"Anne, stop. Your due diligence is appreciated, but you never wanted to be here with me. Just go back to the others. I would hate to further disgust you with my advances."
Cedric rose from the settee and turned his back to where he believed her to be. He was still hard, and it angered him that he wanted her so much, even when he was as upset as this. He desperately wanted to bed a woman who hated his very touch, and touch was the one sense he most relied on now. The irony was almost laughable. Almost. His only advantage was to use her inexperience with passion to overwhelm her.
"You don't disgust me, Lord Sheridan," Anne insisted.
Cedric huffed. "You can't seem to escape me fast enough whenever I let you go."
"I merely can't abide the thought of intimacy before our wedding. I want to obey the rules, even though I know you are far past that point in your experiences."
"Rules? We've broken most of the rules already. One more shouldn't bother you, Anne. That is how I know you don't want me. When two people desire each other, they have trouble waiting. They don't go stiff in each other's arms or pull away from a devoted caress."
Cedric frowned, considering his options. It wasn't too late to call off the ceremony. They had a few days to undo the wedding preparations.
"I'm crying off, Miss Chesley."
He no longer felt the desire to breathe her given name. He'd once loved that her name was one smooth syllable, so easily murmured like a lover's sigh after a moment of bliss. Now it brought him pain.
"Crying off?"
Anne's voice rose sharply.
"Yes, I do not wish to burden you with a husband you don't desire, and I will not shackle myself to a wife who loathes my touch."
"You truly think I loathe you? Look at me!"
Anne spun him forcibly to face her.
"I can't look at you. Surely you haven't forgotten that."
"I haven't, because you won't let me.
You are constantly throwing it in my face, and your friends as well, reminding us of how worthless you think you've become. I do not wish to marry a man who has rebuilt his life around pity. It's infuriating, Cedric.
Anne jabbed a finger in his chest. Cedric couldn't help but grin at her fury.
What could you possibly find so humorous? She sputtered.
You call me Cedra?
He was jerked down, and Anne's mouth fastened fiercely on his, with a thrust of her tongue and a powerful hunger laced in the rhythm of her lips. When she finally released him, she poked him hard in the chest again.
Never think that I do not desire you. And if you even think to cry off, I shall tell everyone in Mayfair that you've compromised me, and you'll have no choice but to marry me. Emily will have Godric drag your body into St. George's by your feet if he has to.
She spun on her heel and left, the dazed Viscount smiling like a lad.
She desires me.
Chapter 8. The White House in Soho Square was filled with the sounds of the rich and elegant seeking their pleasure. It was a night for devilry and revelry. The young bucks who'd been trapped at balls, parties, and sandwiched in the crowds at Almack's since the beginning of the season in January were finally able to escape to less reputable locations and enjoy themselves freely in ways they could not with the eligible ladies under the watchful eyes of their mothers. Even a few ladies who'd borne their husbands the required heirs were taking the night to slip away from their cold marriage beds, along with some adventurous widows, scattered throughout the expensively furnished rooms of the most famous pleasure haunt in London. Samir al-Zahrani exited the skeleton room, one of the more macabre-themed areas within the establishment, his soul blackened with greed. The English provided him a perfect market to carry on his trade, both legal and otherwise, with discretion and near anonymity. Even his father, one of the emissaries visiting London, was unaware of the full extent of Samir's business affairs. Willfully blind was perhaps more accurate. His father was a man of honour, and would have tried to stop him, but Samir knew his father was an old fool who did not recognise opportunity when it presented itself. While his father's business struggled, Samir's thrived, and soon he would surpass his father in both wealth and influence. He moved through the house, admiring the array of mirrors and other unusual additions to the mansion that entranced and enthralled its well-paying guests. His purse was fat with coins and banknotes from his most recent sale of exotic women to furnish the house. No slaves in England, perhaps officially, but those who thought as he did had their quaint little ways around such naive ideals, to avoid unwanted scrutiny. New inventory was in constant demand in the cleaner pleasure haunts. Wealthy men did not want to bed weary and worn middle-aged women. That was where he came in. Samir al-Zahrani travelled the world buying and sometimes stealing rare and exotic women, and occasionally men, to sell to the highest-paying customers, such as the operators of the White House. But Samir's business had little to do with his presence in England today. He'd lost a pair of his most precious assets here a year ago. Two mares sired by his father's famous Arabian racer, the one the English called Firestorm. Samir had been cheated in a card game by a damned Englishman, Sheridan. He would pay for his arrogance and trickery. Samir had vowed to kill the Viscount and take back his mares, but revenge would take time. So Samir had soothed his wounded pride for a time in France before coming back. He'd considered hiring a few local lowlives to murder Viscount Sheridan and make it look like a robbery. His own private guards could have handled such a thing, but this required more care. The last thing he needed was for Sheridan's death to be traced back to him or his country. That would be bad for business. Tonight, he left his guards at home and ventured the streets alone. As he was on his way out of Soho Square, a coach rattled past him and stopped, blocking his path. The muted glow of the street lamps did not seem to penetrate the darkness that cloaked the black coach in his path. Samir felt his hackles rise, like a dog sensing a threat yet unseen. Perhaps he should have brought his guards after all.
Get out of my way!
He snarled up at the driver perched on the coach's front. But the driver remained silent. The door of the coach opened, and a well-manicured hand slid out from the inky depths, inviting Samir to come inside.
You are Al-Zarani, the Arabian merchant, are you not?
The voice was thick with its arrogant presumption of being correct.
Fortune favors you tonight. I am Al-Zarani.
Samir growled. Did this Englishman just think the first dark-skinned man he passed by was the one he sought? He had survived battles in deserts beneath a sun so hot as to kill any man from this wet country. He did not fear one smug English aristocrat.
We have a common enemy, you and I.
The hand beckoned him again, but Samir hesitated.
And what enemy would that be? The man who stole your mares, Viscount Sheridan.
The voice spoke Sheridan's name with such loathing that Samir smiled. His inquiries had reached the right people, it seemed.
You too wish this man dead.
Someday. But first, I want him to suffer, to be humiliated, to never know peace up until the moment of my choosing, the voice from the coach said. Come into my coach, and we will talk. So he'd met an ally, a dangerous one, but an ally nonetheless.
The enemy of my enemy.
Samir hesitated, then reassured himself that his curved blade still rested in the silk lining of his British-style coat. He stepped forward into the carriage. It was almost pitch black. But Samir could make out the tall form of another man across from him, a pale face with hair so dark it melted into the coach's grim interior, gave the impression of a disembodied face gazing back at Samir.
How long have you been back in London? Did you arrive with your father, Ramiz Al-Zarani?
The man asked. Samir had the distinct impression this man knew the answer to his own question. It was a test of honesty.
4 days. How do you know my father?
The man waved his hand. I know quite a bit about him. A well-respected gentleman, welcomed in all London circles. He is a credit to his country. Samir detected no falsity in that declaration, which begged the question why a man who valued his father would be here now talking to him about murder and revenge.
And have you sought word of Sheridan since you arrived?
The man asked.
I have been busy selling my wares.
That is a matter which you and I will speak more of soon. I think that your business interests and mine might just find a common ground. He sensed the man was not referring to his legal facade.
You have an interest in my business?
Samir's laugh was cold. I most certainly do. As I understand, you seek to take some of our stock back to your country. My sources' opinions vary as to the why of the matter. Some say it's because of the exotic price they would fetch. Others, the prestige it would bring and how it might play in terms of power and influence. One acquaintance is convinced a wager is involved somehow. Samir smiled. The man didn't just want him to know that he had information. He wanted him to know he had a number of people supplying him with it. It was an indirect means of laying out his credentials. Spymaster, perhaps. But Samir had his own means of learning about people. Answering a single question could speak volumes.
And what do you think?
The why is irrelevant to me, the man said simply. I'm here to help supply you with some produce. Say, Viscount Sheridan? Samir held his breath. Was this man serious?
You are suggesting I kidnap a Viscount on English soil? That would be impossible.
The Englishman chuckled softly. That is exactly what I'm suggesting. And it is my experience that few things are impossible. Only difficult. If you want to succeed and escape the law, you need only to ask.
He is still the same arrogant bastard he was. I believe I can handle him on my own.
The Englishman shook his head. He might have been smiling. Much has changed since you've been gone. Did you even know that Sheridan has gone blind? The man shared this bit of news with such delight that Samir had no remaining doubt that this man wanted Sheridan dead as well.
Blind? I had not heard. That should make matters easier, however, not more difficult.
Then you do not know the company he keeps. As long as Sheridan is in London, your quest for revenge will indeed be impossible. You also don't realize how little time you have. Next week, he marries a wealthy heiress, the daughter of a recently deceased baron.
And what has this to do with me?
Samir demanded.
His bride has fine English-bred stallions that Sheridan intends to breed with the mares he stole from you.
Samir clenched his fists. His mares were meant for breeding only to other Arabians.
And what is it you propose to do?
Samir asked through gritted teeth.
Sheridan marries in 5 days. I have a man employed at the Sheridan house, and I have learned that Sheridan intends to honeymoon in Brighton. This is where he is keeping your horses. Conveniently, this would also keep him far from those who would protect him.
What do you want from me in this plan of yours?
You have control of a ship.
They both knew that he meant Samir's slave ship.
Yes, I have the services of a ship. The captain has orders from me to dock when and where I tell him.
Excellent. Here is my plan.
Samir leaned forward to listen to the Englishman, a satisfied smile on his lips. Viscount Sheridan and his lovely bride would soon be begging for death, long before Samir would grant them such a mercy. Hugo Waverley watched Samir Alzerani exit his private coach and continue on his way. A minute later, the coach door opened again, and Daniel Sheffield ducked inside, seating himself across from Hugo. Daniel was his best man. The quickest, quietest, and deadliest of all the spies Hugo was in charge of for His Majesty. The man was only in his mid-20s, yet he'd been on more missions than any spy in England. Daniel swept off his hat.
Well, my lord. Did he take the bait?
Settling back in his coach, he lifted his cane and rapped on the roof, signaling to his driver to return home. Then he set the cane across his lap, staring at the wolf-head handle. It was not his favorite cane. That one had been stolen long ago, by Sheridan. He and Essex had attacked Hugo and stolen the cane as a sort of college prank. The devils. Sheridan had dared to keep it as a trophy, a way of mocking Hugo whenever he had the chance.
He'll do as I directed, and abduct Sheridan and his bride. He'll set sail from Brighton, and that's when we shall have the might of His Majesty's Navy ready to sink the ship.
Daniel nodded.
And during their valiant effort to sink a known slaver ship, they'll have killed Sheridan and his wife, not knowing the two were hostage on board.
Exactly. Hugo rubbed his chin thoughtfully. Daniel understood the delicate nature of dealing with Samir Alzerani. His father, Ramiz, was truly a good man, one who would be horrified to discover his son was conducting such a trade under his very nose. Yet it was Ramiz's influence with the throne that kept his son safe from any obvious recriminations. Samir couldn't be brought to trial for his part in the slave trade, a practice Hugo detested on every level. So why not let the foolish man believe Hugo was on his side, then strike when the man had done Hugo's dark deeds for him? But if Samir were to die in a tragic accident, when his ship was sunk, after ignoring orders to stop and present his cargo for inspection, well, that would be a pity. A smile curved his lips.
Two birds and one stone. Or cannonball, rather,
Daniel added.
What is my next assignment, my lord?
Watch Samir and watch Sheridan. Both are hot-headed fools.
We need to make sure one does not incite the other to act before the time is right.
The kidnapping needs to occur during their honeymoon at Brighton, not before. Sheridan has too many friends protecting him here. Daniel nodded, no doubt remembering Hugo's last two plans unraveling due to this fact. I'll arrange the naval interference. The HMS Ranger should be docking there around the time we need Samir's vessel to be sunk. Lifting his wolf-headed cane again, Hugo rapped the roof twice to stop the coach. It rocked to a halt on Curzon Street, where Sheridan lived. Daniel put his hat back on and slipped out of the vehicle like a wraith in the night. If only you knew how closely you are being watched. How closely all you rogues are being watched. Inside every house, he had a man watching, waiting, feeding him information. When the time was right, the men would act, snuffing out any rogues who were left, one by one. But that was the end game. Now he would enjoy the middle game, his one vice in life, in an otherwise unshakable career of service to his country. I will avenge you, Peter. They will pay for the night they let you die. They will pay. Then you can rest. And maybe I can as well. It was a vow carved into his heart, and he would see it through at any cost. Chapter 9. Cedric fingered the stack of cards Ashton had abandoned on the table.
You know, Ash, you're not my favorite friend at the moment.
Ashton chuckled.
You wound me, Cedric.
Cedric huffed and listened to the sounds of